Thank you. Well, good evening. How are you tonight? I'll ask that again. How are you tonight? Oh, good. There you are. I am so glad you're here this evening. Last night, just a little bit of a review. Last night, we covered how the Jesus we see in the Jesus story, we find an itinerant teacher traveling the countryside, not selling a special prayer that you would pray to get some ticket to some post-mortem bliss. No, he came proclaiming that his kingdom had come to earth. And he invited those who were within earshot of him, anyone who was listening, to join that kingdom. That kingdom was a radical new way of doing life on this planet that was rooted and grounded in significant paradigm shifts in how we see God, how we see ourselves, and how we see one another. How Jesus taught us to live is not conventional. It is not domesticated. It is quite revolutionary. And we're going to see that as we continue this week. I want to lay a little bit of a foundation this evening in the first half before we get into a concept that we must understand if we're going to embrace the ethical teachings of Jesus this week. The foundation for that is, for the title for this foundation is, where are you getting your life? And I want to define that for you as well. What do we mean by life? I don't mean the fact that you're breathing right now. What I mean by where are you getting your life, if you look in your notes there, what I'm asking by that question is, what is it that gives you worth? What is it that gives you value? What is it that gives you assurance? What is it that gives you security? What is it that defines you? I'm going to read a few passages here for a moment, just a few examples, and I want you to tell me where that's going to require some thought. I want you to tell me where these people are getting their life, their value, their worth, their assurance, what defines them. It says, a couple with two kids purchases a bigger and more luxurious house than they need, even though it means they'll both have to work more and see each other and the kids less. Where are they getting their value? Maybe wealth, or at least what aspect of wealth? The size of their house. How many of you have met people, and maybe it's you know of people, it might be even yourself, who get a lot of what makes you who you are from what makes them who they are from the type of house they live in? How many have bumped into that phenomenon? The second one, a Hindu woman prays to a shrine of Vishnu 3 times a day. Where is she getting her life? This one's harder for you to see. From her religion, from her religious disciplines. That's what defines her. Despite failing health, one of the world's 950 or so billionaires continues to work 15 or more hours a day and rarely takes vacations. Where are they getting their life? What defines them? Yeah, their work. A middle-aged man leaves his wife of 20 years to move in with a woman half his age. He starts smoking cigarettes and driving a Harley. A perfectly normal-looking middle-aged woman spends a year's salary on breast implants, a facelift, a tummy tuck, thigh reduction. She then becomes unsatisfied with the size of her lips and nose. A Christian group carries signs like God hates fags, and they picket the military burial of a gay Marine. Where are they getting their life? Despite having a sexually transmitted disease, a young woman compulsively engages in sexual intercourse with virtual strangers on a regular basis. What is it that defines her and makes her feel worth something? One teen stabs another at school in retaliation for being publicly insulted. Where is that person getting there? Don't look at the behavior. Look at why the behavior is taking place. Where are they getting their life, their worth, their security, their assurance, their value? A husband and a father puts his family in financial distress by continuing to pursue his gambling addiction behind their backs. What's he living for? This is a pastor habitually gossips about others. Where are they getting their life? I want you to look in your handout this evening at John chapter 5. 39 through 40. And this is going to come as a shock to some of you. John 5, 39 through 40, Jesus said, and he's talking to the Pharisees, the religious leaders of his day, the religious folk. He said, "You study the what? The scriptures, because you think that in them you find what? Eternal life. These are the very scriptures that speak about who? Yet you are not willing to come to," what does he say? "Me to have life." Now, in order to understand what I think he's saying, this world is set on a trajectory with destruction. How many would agree with that? The direction we're moving in is not healthy. Jesus came and he established his kingdom on this planet to offer to humanity a new way of doing life that puts them on a trajectory of things that lead to life and health and happiness and peace. If you agree with that so far, say yes. Where were they trying to get their life from? What defines them, their security, their hope? Where were they getting that from? I didn't say this, Jesus said it. But where were they trying to get their hope from? The scriptures. And Jesus said, you're trying to get your life, your security, what defines you, from the scriptures, and yet you won't come to who? Me, that you might get life. That's scary. Because what here, don't get upset at me, what is Jesus contrasting with himself as a source of life? The scriptures. What on earth is he doing here? How many of you, though, have ever met someone who we could use just as many examples as we already have, that someone gets what defines them or their value or their security from understanding the Bible? How many have met people like that? In other words, they're not getting their life or their worth from Jesus. They're getting it from how they worship Jesus. Do you understand? It's a subtle difference. It's much easier to see when someone's getting their life from their gambling addiction or their substance addiction or their materialistic addiction. It's much easier to see, but it's much more difficult to see when people are getting their life from their religion rather than from Jesus. But is that possible as well? How many have ever bumped into that? Yeah, that's possible. Much more subtle, because it's a religion about Jesus rather than Jesus himself. Jesus said it this way in John 10:10. He says, the thief comes only to, what does it say? Steal, kill, and what? This world is on a trajectory which ends with them experiencing these tragedies. He says, I have come that they might have what? Life, and have it to the full. Or as some would say, life, what's the title of this series? Life Unlimited. Jesus was calling them to follow him that they might have life. Let me put this illustration on the board and it'll make probably help, most likely to help. I'm hoping it helps. These are concentric circles. Now, these circles indicate levels of importance, levels of value. Things on the outside are important, but they're not as important at things closer to the center. Now, whom did Jesus want to be placed at the center of our concentric circles? Himself. What were these religious people placing at the center of their concentric circles? According to Jesus, what were they putting there? The scriptures. So let's put the Bible there. If the Bible is what defines you, if the Bible is what gives you value, then you are going to evaluate others based upon how they agree or disagree with your interpretation of that book. If they agree with you, they're part of your tribe. If they disagree with you, they're not part of your tribe. How many have bumped into that before? Yeah, and people get a lot of value from understanding that. I want to introduce to you tonight the greatest Bible scholar that has ever lived. Do you know who it is? It's the devil. Do you think the devil, bless his heart, I'm in the South so I can say that, right? Do you think he understands exactly what the Bible's teaching? Oh, yes. Interesting. When that's at the center of your concentric circles. Now, don't be concerned. We're not throwing out the Bible. It's still going to be on the screen. But let's see where Jesus places it. Let's talk about a couple other things before we get there so that we can see it. If we take that Bible out of there and we put in the middle, and let's make that middle circle a little larger so that we can write some stuff in. If we place in the middle there maybe a special doctrine. How many have ever seen a religious group do that before? And you're valued based upon whether or not you agree with this doctrine. How many have ever seen that happen? Or, let's put this in instead. A certain behavior. What defines you? Well, I do this. Well, I do that. How many have ever seen a religious group do that before? And we could go on lists. We could actually be specific and put down actual examples. What's interesting to me is Jesus said all of that may be well and good and the things you may be doing may be right, but when you place them at the center of your concentric circles instead of me, what does the Bible call it when we give something else a place that only Jesus is to have? What do we call that? It's called idolatry. And Jesus is warning the religious folks of his day of not even making the scriptures into an idol. I don't know if that confronts anyone else in the room besides me, but it challenges me to my core. Is there anyone else with me tonight? They say that misery loves company, so I thought I would invite you in on mine a little bit tonight. What does it mean to have Jesus at the center of our concentric circles? Well, there's going to, if Jesus is what defines us, then Jesus has a certain set of teachings. And we'll put those right out here. Teachings. Are those going to be valuable to us if we're a follower of Jesus? Yes. Let's talk about God for a moment. Is God going to be valuable to us? We are most likely going to be theists because Jesus did not give his teachings in the vacuum of atheism. Jesus taught that there was an actual God, and he actually defined for us what that God was. Now, there's some benefits to approaching it like this, and I want you to notice the subtle difference. We don't follow Jesus because we can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt the existence of God. How many realize that's impossible, proving beyond a shadow of a doubt that he's out there? But did we see in night number one that there was significant evidence for believing in the historical reliability of the Jesus story? How many were here night number one and you saw that evidence? And so therefore, if we become a follower of Jesus, we're not believing in Jesus because we can prove God. We see enough evidence to follow Jesus, so we're following Jesus. And because we're a Jesus follower, we also believe we're a God. That there is a God. Sorry. It also actually gives us one step ahead. Not only do we believe there is a God, it's actually better than theism alone. Because theism just states that God exists. It doesn't define what God is. If you believe in God as a Jesus follower, you not only believe that there's a God out there, but you have a significant clue in regards to what kind of a person that God really is. How many can see that tonight? Let me see your hands. It makes a significant difference. Something else that's going to make that's going to be important to you is people. And this is incredibly important because today you have significant numbers of people who claim to be following Jesus. They're calling themselves Christians. But in their everyday life, at the center of their concentric circles is not, and I don't mean all of them, this is just a certain section of them, but there's a lot of them out there. What's at the center of their concentric circles is a set of rules. And you're important in relation to the degree that you follow these rules. But the rules are the most important thing around here, and that's what we've got to protect more than anything else. I'll give you an example with Jesus. Jesus met a woman one day in a precarious situation. He was walking through a crowd, and he felt someone touch him. Now, he turns around and he asks, "Who touched me?" What's the background of this story? This woman had an issue of blood. She had been bleeding for quite some time. What did the law of Leviticus, the religious rule of their day, what did it state about those who had bodily emissions? They shall not what? Do you know Leviticus? Talk to me tonight. They shall not what? If we get out late tonight again, it's your fault. We shall not what? Touch anyone. But she needed to be healed. Now, she doesn't want to break the rule. And so some people think, well, look at all that. Look at that faith. She thought, if I could just touch the hem of his garment, that's enough to heal me. That's not what she was doing. She was trying to not break the rule, not really touch him, but just touch the hem of his garment in hopes that that would be enough to heal her. So she touches the hem of his garment. She gets healed. Jesus stops in the crowd, and it's on purpose. He quotes the book of Leviticus on purpose and says, "Who touched me?" Now, Peter, bless his heart, gives me hope. Anybody here, Peter gives you hope? Peter says, "What do you mean, who touched you? We're in a crowd. Everybody's touching you." I can imagine Jesus just shaking his head. He says, "No, who touched me?" And the woman steps out of the crowd. And what emotion does the story say she was feeling? It says she was afraid. Now, she had just been healed. Why is she afraid? Because in order to be healed, what did she have to, in order to get to Jesus, what did she have to do? She had to break the rule. And Jesus, why is she afraid? What is she expecting from Jesus? Talk to me. Condemnation, censure, correction, and judgment. And yet Jesus tells her, "Be at peace. Your faith has made you whole." Now, if the rules are at the center of your concentric circles tonight, that story is going to send you through the toolies. How many know what I understand what I'm saying by that? It's going to really cause you some consternation. But when Jesus had to make a decision between the importance of a rule or the importance of a person, which did he always give greater value to? To people. And so people are going to matter most to us as well. And lastly, we'll put the Bible back on the screen. For all of you who thought we were throwing out the Bible, you can breathe now. The Bible's up there. It's important. But notice, we don't follow Jesus because we can prove the inerrancy of a book. We follow Jesus because of the evidence for following Jesus that you saw night number one, presentation number two. And you give the Bible a place in your life as a follower of Jesus. Because did Jesus give the Scriptures authority in his life? Yes. And so you do the same. But even the Scriptures are held underneath the authority of who? Of Jesus. Jesus helps us now understand the Scriptures. Have you ever met someone, just to illustrate why this is so vital, have you ever met someone who they had a really good Bible verse for what they were doing, but they were really weird? Anybody ever met someone like that before? There are some dangerous people on this planet that can substantiate why they're doing what they're doing with Bible verses. Am I right? Yes. Is it important to not have just the Bible on the screen, but to, even before you get to the Bible, have Jesus on the screen helping you understand the Bible? See, the teachings of Jesus must come first. The paradigm shifts of Jesus must come first. What does it mean in genuineness to allow Jesus to start defining who you are and give you value and worth and assurance and security? Well, let's go to an event in the Jesus story itself for a second. How do you know how much something is worth? Like your house. How do you know how much your house is worth? Any ideas? Yeah, usually you'll call an appraiser. And what does the appraiser do? The appraiser goes around and gets something. What do they get? Comps. That's right. And what are comps? He's looking at sales, recent sales, of homes in your area, of houses that were similar to yours. And all he's trying to discover is how much someone is willing to pay for a house like yours. So worth is really how much someone is willing to pay. How about a car? How do you know how much a car is worth? You usually open up a book of which the color is blue, or at least that's the name, and you search for a car in that year, that model, that make, and you see in your condition what someone is willing to what? Pay. So how do you know how much your car is worth? You find out how much someone was willing to pay. How about a work of art? That's way more subjective even. Well, how about a work of art? There's no way to really tell how much a work of art is worth. It's simply how much someone is willing to what? And there may be no difference between this work of art by this person and this work of art by this person, but just because this one was done by this individual and this individual's more famous, people are willing to pay more for that work of art. Therefore, that work of art is worth more. But worth is based simply on how much someone is willing to what? To pay. Now, pause that for a second there. Come over here to this question. How much is God worth? Can you value it? Can you estimate it? Can you measure it? So then you would have to say that God's worth is immeasurable. If you agree, say yes. You would have to say that God's worth is inestimable. If you agree with that, say yes. And you would have to say then tonight that His worth is infinite. If you would agree with that, say yes. So it's immeasurable, infinite. What was the third one? Inestimable. That's right. Thank you. Inestimable, immeasurable, and infinite. Now, put these two together. In the Jesus story, we have an event where Jesus came to this planet and He saw every single one of us set on a trajectory towards death. And how much was He willing to give, to get us to Himself and on the path of life? How much was He willing to give for every single one of us? Everything He had. Now you just told me, what is He worth? It's immeasurable, inestimable, and infinite. And if He was willing to give up everything to get you, what does that say about your worth to Him? What I'm asking you tonight is not how big your house is. What I'm asking you tonight is not what you do for work, even. What I'm asking you tonight is not where you went to college or what university you graduated with or what degree is behind your name. I'm not asking you if you're attractive or ugly. I'm not asking if you're thin or fat. Regardless, I'm not asking how much is in your bank account. I'm not asking whether you're male or female or what the color of your skin is. I'm asking one thing and one thing only. How much does the Jesus story say that you are worth to God right now, sitting in that pew, just as you are? What is it that defines you tonight? Because the Jesus story says that you, to Jesus, are immeasurable. You are of infinite value. You are of inestimable worth. And for how many is that good news tonight? That's what it means to first and foremost have Jesus at your concentric circles. It means to allow what the Jesus story says about you to define you. You're going to be challenged during this series with a paradigm shift in how you see God. You're going to be challenged in this series with paradigm shifts in how you look at everyone else. But which one of the three paradigm shifts is this one challenging right now? It's how you choose to see who? Yourself. Jesus is imploring you, if you want life unlimited, the first thing you have to do is submit to God's picture of you. If you can embrace that, how many is that good news for? How many would like to say, Lord, all the voices in my head are going nuts right now. Would you please help me begin seeing myself the way you do? How many would like to say that prayer tonight? Yeah, because you hear it. You hear all the excuses. Man, the voices in your head are so loud right now, I could even hear them up here on stage. Are you with me? I know what's going on in your headspace. Look at Matthew 7, 1 through 6. Jesus looks to his disciples and says, "Do not judge, or you too will be judged." What's the context here? Why is he saying this? Well, his disciples are sitting there and they're listening to Jesus one day, and then they all of a sudden stop and their attention kind of veers, and they look around and they see, well, Peter notices he's sitting next to Matthew over here, and Matthew notices he's sitting next to Peter over here. And why is that a problem? Well, who's Peter? He's a zealot. Who's Matthew? He's a tax collector. He's in cohorts with the empire, with Rome, the enemy. That would be almost the equivalent of sitting there next to Jesus and seeing, being a Democrat, you're sitting next to a Republican, or a Republican that you're sitting next to a Democrat. Are you with me so far? And then Peter looks to the other side of him and he sees, well, next to him over here is a prostitute named Ginger. And why is that a problem? Well, because who did he expect to be in the audience listening to Jesus? Who was he hoping would be there? What crowd did he hope that following Jesus would land him in? The Pharisees, the teachers of the law, the priests, the religious leaders? And where were they at this moment? Were they in the crowd? No, they were out plotting Jesus's death. And so if you were Peter sitting there one day looking at the prostitutes and the tax collectors, and this is the crowd mom and dad always told me not to hang out with, and here I am listening to Jesus, and this is the kind of crowd that's being attracted to this Jesus, would you have been tempted to feel maybe you had made the wrong decision in picking him as your Messiah? Would you have been tempted to do that? And so Jesus turns to his disciples and says, "Listen, when you're looking to your left and to your right, don't judge, or you too will be judged. In the same way you judge others, you will be judged. With what measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in someone else's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye?" The first thing I want you to notice here is Jesus is giving us the law of reciprocation. For years, Christianity has looked on a certain section of society as being morally inferior. And today, what is the kickback from that? Today, we have scholars, atheists, and agnostics, which look now at Christians and call them inferior as well. Do they not? They call them intellectually inferior. Do you see the law of reciprocation there? In what manner you judge, it will be judged to you. He says, why do you look at the second thing I want you to notice? Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in someone else's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own? Whatever sin we see in others when we look to our left and our right as we're following Jesus, whatever sin we see in them, I don't care what it is, we're to see it as a speck of dust compared to the plank in our own eye. What is Jesus really teaching here? Some people have said that the solution to really reaching the sinner is loving the sinner but hating the sin. How many have ever heard that before? Yeah, I'll tell you why that's a subtle, not far enough. It may be a subtle counterfeit. It's not. Jesus isn't saying here, love the sinner, hate the sin. What Jesus is saying is love the sinner and hate your own sin. And when you've got your own sin dealt with, then you'll be able to see clearly to help other sinners around you. But while you're feeling morally superior to others, you have no business even talking about their sin. You say, well, Herb, Jesus did tell the woman caught in the midst of adultery to go and sin no more. You're right, he did. But number one, he did it in private. How many noticed that? And number two, did Jesus have a plank in his own eye when he said it to her? No. See, we have to be very careful when we look at others, even in our reaching out to them, to not be judging them as morally inferior to us. Whatever sin we see in someone else, we're to see it again as a speck of dust compared to our own sin. He says, how can you say, let me take the speck out of your own eye, when all the time there's a plank out of your eye, when all the time there's a plank in your own? You hypocrite, first, what's our job? First, do what? Take the plank out of what? your own eye. Then you will see clearly to remove the speck from another person's eyes. If we see sin in someone else, what is our first responsibility? It's not to tell them about it. What's our first responsibility? Self-introspection. Do I have something that I need to let Jesus deal with first? And once that's dealt with, then can I go and help someone with what they're struggling with? How many realize that if just a handful of Christians would do that in America today, people would have a totally different impression of what Christians are all about? If just a handful would practice this. But then he goes on, and this is the point. This is what we're getting to. He says, do not give to dogs what is what? And do not throw your pearls to what? To swine, to pigs. What is that all about? I was once told that, Herb, before you share your precious gems of truth and these nuggets with people, that you need to evaluate whether or not they're worth it. You know, don't just throw your pearls before swine. Well, why is that not the way to interpret this passage? What did Jesus just tell us not to do? Talk to me, not to judge. Now you're telling me I got to judge someone before I can share truth with them? That's a contradiction, isn't it? So what is he really saying? Notice he's saying, let's put it in the vernacular, he's saying to his disciples, you wouldn't take that which is sacred and treat it like dog food. You wouldn't take pearls and throw them out with the pig slop. These people that you're looking to the left and to the right and judging, these are sacrosanct creatures to me. Stop treating them like dog food. These are sacrosanct pearls to me. They are of immeasurable, infinite, inestimable worth to me. Stop treating them like pig slop. How many can see what Jesus is saying here tonight? He's saying, not only allow yourself to be valued and defined by Jesus, but now take one more step and start defining everyone else around you. Put Jesus in the center of their concentric circles and start defining their worth and their value based on the Jesus story too. Again, if just a handful of Jesus followers would do this, how many can see the potential for that to change so many things? So much would be revolutionized by this. This is part of the ethical teachings of Jesus. His first teaching was to put himself where? In the center. Not your belief system, not your lifestyle, not your religion, not the size of your house or your bank account or your job or your education. The first thing we are to put in the center of our concentric circles is the value that Jesus places on each one of us. And then, I hate to say this, because this is going to sound like a contradiction to everything I've just said, but you're not that special. And what I mean by that is you're not unique. What's true about you in this paradigm is true about everyone else. And that when you begin to see others that way, that's a paradigm shift. See, what Jesus is really proposing, when he talks about the kingdom, he's talking about a new community, a new group of human beings who have Jesus at the center of their concentric circles. They have Jesus as their Lord. They're following him. You see, if you put other things in the center of your concentric circles, what you end up doing is having a community that looks like this, and everybody that agrees, whatever it is that you're defining yourself and others by, that becomes the perimeter. Are you with me? And people are either on the inside of it, or they're on the outside of it. And what you end up doing inevitably is having some people who start gathering around the borders of this community, and they are what people call the gatekeepers. They're determining who can be let in and who has to be kept out. Well, because do you agree with this? And do you do this? And do you do that? Or do you do this? You know what I find interesting? Bear with me. Do you know what I find interesting? There was a thief, it says, that was crucified beside Jesus on the cross. How many know that story? The political rebel. And he looked at, there was one that was railing him with accusations. Another one looked at him and said, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. You know what I find beautiful? What did the thief call Jesus? Lord. Jesus immediately saw the heart orientation of this gentleman toward himself. What was this man beginning to place at the center of his concentric circles in that moment? Jesus. What I find beautiful as well is that when he said, "Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom," he didn't look at the guy and say, "Well, do you smoke?" He didn't say, "Well, how old do you think the earth is?" He didn't say, "Well, do you believe in this doctrine, this doctrine, and this doctrine?" All he looked at was the heart orientation of the man. What was at the center of his concentric circles? And he said, "Welcome to the kingdom." Now, granted, if that guy would have come down off the cross, would his life over time been radically changed as he followed Jesus? Was his life on a trajectory towards death? Yes. And in choosing to embrace Jesus as his Lord, and in orienting his life and putting Jesus at the center of his concentric circles, in doing that, would he have been placed on a path that in its trajectory would have continued to produce life after life after life, which would have included a lot of changes for this man in the process? But which comes first? Life change or entrance into the kingdom? Which comes first? Entrance into the kingdom. See, we think you need to... See, imagine there's a table here full of food. And religion typically says, well, if you'll clean up your act first, then you can have a seat at the table. Jesus says, hey, there's food here. Are you hungry? And you'll say, well, I was kicked out by that other group. That other group didn't want me around. You know, they said I was excluded, that I wasn't welcomed. And he said, I don't care what they said. Here, have a, here's a chair. Here's a plate. Just come and... Yeah, but what about that? I'm not worried about that right now. Are you hungry? Well, here's some food. Just come and eat. And as that person sits at the table with Jesus, is their life going to be radically revolutionized? Yes. But does Jesus say you have to clean it up before you can sit at the table? No, all he says is, if you're hungry, come and eat. Let's have some dinner first. We'll take care of that stuff later. How many are thankful for a Jesus like that? Is that the Jesus you see in the Jesus story? But it ticks off those who have other things at the center of their religious circles, doesn't it? The Pharisees, who had the Torah at the center of their concentric circles, did it bother them that Jesus ate with tax collectors and sinners? Yes, it infuriated them. It rustled their feathers a little bit. You see, the type of community that Jesus is trying to create does not look like this. It is not defined by a perimeter. The type of community that Jesus is seeking to create is defined by a center. And let's put J right there. That's the center. Now, let's put that original perimeter still there. So everyone can see that perimeter? You've still got people inside that perimeter and outside that perimeter. But if you're judging who's in or out based on their heart orientation to Jesus, that's what the community looks like, really. You see, you have Jesus in the center, and this person may be part of this group here with the circles, may be part of that group, but their heart could be moving away from Jesus, couldn't it? And so that even though they're within this perimeter, they're moving in this direction. While this person is in process, they're moving toward, their heart is oriented towards Jesus, they're moving towards Jesus. Are they going to cross that border at some point? Sure they are. Sure they are. But notice, they're part of the kingdom even out there. If that makes sense to you, say yes. We're to be about enlarging the kingdom first and foremost, which means living lives that put on display what this world looks like when it's changed by Jesus Christ. And when people see that and say, man, I want to be a part of that, it doesn't matter where they are in relation to this perimeter. If their heart orientation has changed and they're moving towards Jesus, which is at the center, Jesus looks at them and says, "Welcome to the kingdom." Is there anybody out there that would say amen to that tonight? We're to be enlargers of the kingdom. It does. It requires putting something very different at the center of our circles. It doesn't mean that other stuff isn't important. See, we're so all or nothing. If we were to have those concentric circles up there, there would be things at the outside of those concentric circles that are still important. They're still on the screen. But would they be as important as Jesus? No. Still valuable. But Jesus has to be of primary importance. What is it that defines you? It's so important that we get this, because there is going to come one night for every one of you in this room. And I don't know which one it's going to be, but there's going to come one night for every one of you where what is it that defines you is going to be challenged by Jesus to its core. And in that moment, you're going to have to make a decision to let go of that which gives you value. And lay hold of Jesus and follow Him and allow Him to give you value. You say, "Well, Herb, I go to church every week." Did the churchgoers, if we could call them that in Jesus' day, were they immune to being confronted by Jesus' radical new way of doing life? Or were they challenged by it too? And God forbid we should think that we're immune to it. Whether you're a visitor here tonight or whether you're a member here, it will challenge you. Look at Matthew 5, 43 through 45. Let's review and then we'll break for our intermission. It says, "You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor, hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven." Was this, once again, a radical reorientation in how human beings are to do life on planet Earth? Yes. And notice why. You will be children of your Father in heaven because He causes His Son to rise on the evil and the good. He sends rain on the righteous and the... Jesus is calling us to love as indiscriminately as the sun shines and the rain falls. That means if they're a recipient of the rain or if the sun shines on them, you've got one job and one job only as a Jesus follower. And what is it? It's to love them, even if they're your enemy. Even if they've done something against you, if the sun's shining on them, to love them. Now that's challenging. How many would agree with that? That's difficult. That's going to take a miracle. We're going to talk about that more in a future night. But what I want you to understand first, this was a reorientation of how we do life, and it was based on a radical paradigm shift in their picture of who? Of God. That's because He's saying, "I live like this because that's the way the Father is too." And that's our example. Look at Luke 6:21-25. Jesus said, "Blessed are you who are hungry, who hunger now. Woe to you who are what? Fed now." Now, some people say the gospel, which is, remember, we defined it last night, the kingdom has come. People say the gospel or the kingdom, the gospel is good news to everybody. And I want to contest that for just a second. The kingdom is for everybody. How many would agree with that? But it is not initially good news to everybody. Because right here, what does Jesus say? Blessed are you who are what now? Hungry. If you're the life is oriented in a certain way right now on planet Earth, where there are people at the top of the pyramid and people at the bottom of the pyramid. And whose favor is that pyramid in? Talk to me. People at the top. Jesus comes and says, blessed are you if you're hungry right now. This kingdom, this radical reorientation of how I've come to set up life on planet Earth, this is going to be in the favor of those on the bottom rung of the pyramid. If you're hungry now, you're going to be blessed by this kingdom that I'm establishing. But then He turns and says, but woe to you who are what? Well fed. If you're being benefited by the way life is orchestrated right now, when I turn this thing on its head, that's going to be very challenging for you. Those who are well fed, would they have looked at the news that this kingdom had arrived? Would they have looked at that as good news? No. They would have felt like, this is not good news to me. This is bad news to me. Now that's how they would have perceived it. And that's what I want you to be aware of. There are going to be times this week when you're going to feel what Jesus is calling you to do is not good news for you. Listen to me. You may be benefited by the way life is orchestrated right now, but the trajectory of the way life is orchestrated right now is a trajectory of death. That's where it ends. And the only reason Jesus is trying to pull you from this path over to this path is not to make your life harder, and it's not because he doesn't like you. It's actually because he loves you. And even though it's a radical reorientation and it may cost some of you some things, he's only calling you from this path to this path because this is the way of life. You see, he says in Mark, Jesus looked at him and what? Loved him. This is the rich young ruler. And so Jesus said, "One thing you lack," he said, "go sell everything you have and give it to the poor, and you'll have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me." Do not spiritualize it. We're too good at doing that. Take it literally. Let me ask you, do you think that rich dude thought this was good news at this moment? Now, was it going to save his soul if he could do that? Would it take him off the path? Oh, see, you don't understand what I'm saying. You're still in that meritorious thing. You're still in the ticket to go to heaven. I'm not talking about a ticket to go to heaven. I'm talking about, would it have changed his life in the here and now if he would have done that? Would it have set him on the path of life rather than the path of death if he would have done that? Yes, intrinsically it would have done that. Not meritoriously, but intrinsically it would have done that. And why was Jesus telling him to do it? Because he what? Because he loved him and he was inviting him into a better way. But once again, how did the rich young ruler feel about it? It says he walked away because it was too what? Too hard, too difficult. I share those with you tonight because Jesus has come offering you life unlimited. How many want that kind of life? Are you sure? Because when Jesus gives it to you, you may be in the position of this dude here tonight where it looks like that's going to kill you if you do that. It's going to go counterintuitive to everything you've ever been taught. Everything you've ever been raised to believe about how life is to be played in order to get the best out of life. Jesus is going to challenge that at its core. How many have met Jesus before and you know what I'm talking about? He's going to challenge it at its core. And initially, you're going to be tempted to feel like, well, this doesn't sound like good news at all. But if you will just follow Jesus, if you'll trust him, he knows what he's talking about. And his way may seem like the end of your world if you follow him. It is the beginning to a whole new world. A world that ends in life and life to the full. Now, again, just be aware. When you see this happening, here's my testimony. A few years back, I had written a book called Finding the Father. Anybody read that book by chance? I'm in the Carolinas, and I know a few of you have. I was coming back from a radio interview. It was the second largest Christian radio station in the nation, and they had just done an hour-long interview with me about this book. And I come back to my hotel room, and I'm just laying there looking at the ceiling, feeling like, man, something is missing. Have you ever felt like that, where you had all the right answers, but you still felt like something was missing? I'd just written this powerful book, and people keep writing letters into me every day in emails saying, "Herb, this book has changed my life," and I'm so happy for those who that happened for, but I still felt like, man, there's something missing. And so the Holy Spirit at that moment brought up a convention that I had been a guest speaker in the year before. And there was a fellow speaker there that was doing some talks. And I really liked him. I'm very picky, and I don't usually like most preachers. I'll just be honest with you. I just think most of them are preaching Gnosticism and Constantinian Christianity rather than what Jesus taught. But then again, maybe I need to get the log out of my own eye. I get it. But I liked this guy. And the Holy Spirit said, "Well, why don't you check out some of his stuff? He's a pastor. He's got all of his sermons online. Why don't you check him out?" So I clicked over his website and I listened to his sermon from the previous weekend. And he was right there in the middle of a 6.5 year series on the book of Luke. How many would love to come to a church where every week for 6.5 years you were in the book of Luke? Well, I thought, what a novel idea. I have spent my entire Christian history, my entire Christian experience, trying to get inside the headspace of this author and this author and see what this author was about and this author was about. And I've looked at Calvin and I've looked at Augustine and I've looked at Luther and I've looked at, you know, this author and this author and this author. And I've always tried to get their theological, you know, what did they believe? You know, the one person which was, I can't believe I had missed this. Do you know who the one person was that I'd never given that honor to? Jesus. I said, what would happen if I dedicated the next 6 years of my life to just trying to get inside the headspace of Jesus and figure out what Jesus was about, what he was passionate for, what his kingdom was centered in and about, what his agenda was, what topics did Jesus preach about, what did he get excited for, and try to get inside the headspace of Jesus. And can I be honest with you tonight? Some people have a testimony where your life was a train wreck and Jesus brought order to your train wreck. He literally picked you up out of a mess and saved your soul. How many have a testimony like that? I value those kinds of testimonies. That is not my testimony. This is my testimony. I was addicted not to substances, not to gambling, not to women, not to riches. I was addicted to religion. That was my addiction. And Jesus did not bring order to my chaos. I had everything pretty much organized, categorized, labeled. I knew all the correct beliefs, all the correct behaviors. And I have to stand before you tonight and tell you that Jesus has not brought order to my chaos. He has dropped a bomb in the middle of my order. And I'm just white-knuckling it still, if you'll forgive me. I'm just hanging on for the ride. Following Jesus, understand what I mean when I say this in the context of what I've said tonight. Following Jesus is more than being a Christian. Following Jesus will ruin your life. Did you hear me say that? But it only feels like that initially. How many know what I'm talking about right now? But he will ruin your life, and so just be ready for it. He's going to challenge you this week in some very fundamental ways. And if you will get past that and actually leap off the cliff, I promise you he will catch you. And you will be doing more than the walking that you used to do through life. You will be soaring above the heights if you'll just get over the initial fear. Choose to follow Jesus. Where are we at? When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said, "You're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?" For the Jews didn't associate with Samaritans. Jesus answered, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." "Sir," the woman said, "you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and drank from it himself, and did also his sons and flocks and herds?" Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks of this water, he'll be thirsty again. But those who drink of the water that I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water, so that I won't get thirsty, and I have to keep coming here to get water, to draw water." He told her, "Go and call your what? And then come back." What is this the beginning of? Which phase of following Jesus is this the beginning of? This is the ruin my life phase, all right? In order to get to the living water, what does Jesus have to talk about with this woman? Does she want to talk about this? No. And so she says, and rightly so, she says, "I have no husband," she replied. How many can see that? She's trying to skirt the issue. "I have no husband." You know the story. He said to her, "You're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you've had how many? 5 husbands, and the man you're with now is not even your husband." Jesus is saying, the way they say it in the South, "You're just living in sin. What you have just said is quite true." Now, if you pulled this tactic with most people, what would be their response? "Mind your own business." That's right. If you did it, if they were a visitor at your church here and you did this, what would they do? They would leave, and would they ever come back? Now, what I find wild is what this woman did. Then, leaving her water jar, she forgot her water jar. Do you get that detail? She is so preoccupied, she forgets her water jar, and the woman went back to the town and said to the people, "Come see a man who told me everything I ever did." Do you have people in your life that like to point out all the things you do wrong? What are your feelings towards those kinds of people? Yeah, do you like to hang out with them? And the last thing you're going to do is want to go invite other people to come meet them. Am I right? What is wrong with this woman? Jesus says you've been married 5 times, you've had 5 husbands, and you're not even married to the guy you're sleeping with now. And she gets excited and goes tell everybody, "Hey, come meet this guy who told me everything bad I've ever done." What on earth is going on in this story? Because Jesus isn't pointing out her sin. Jesus is trying to give her the living water. What does that mean? I think what Jesus is trying to communicate to her in this moment is, "Listen, lady, I know everything there is to know about you. And my offer's still on the table." How many wanted Jesus like that? This woman, regardless of her marital past, was of infinite, immeasurable, inestimable worth to that Jesus. Do you see it there? And did she? That's the living water, putting Jesus at the center of your concentric circles. Doesn't it satisfy your soul longings? You felt it. You tasted a little bit of it tonight, didn't you? How many tonight was more than just an intellectual paradigm shift? You actually felt something on an emotional level at some point in tonight's presentation. Anyone? Yes. What you drank tonight was that living water that gives worth and value to your soul, coming from Jesus being at the center of your concentric circles. And did it create in her a well that sprang up and overflowed to others? Did she run back to town and say, "You got to come meet this guy too. Come meet a man who'll tell you everything you ever did wrong, but it won't change the way he thinks and feels towards you. It won't change your value to him. It won't change your worth to him." Now again, did Jesus have to bring up her marital past to get her to that point? Yes, but she continued in the process, and did she find living water that led to life everlasting? That's what I'm inviting you to do this week. Jesus is going to challenge us with his ethics. But if we'll see, the only reason he's sharing these things with us is because he loves us. We're on a collision course with death, and he's wanting to get us on a collision course with life. And it's going to look like he's ruining your world, but just follow him, and you'll see what he's offering you is a new world. That's radically different, that operates by radically different principles, based upon a radically different way of seeing God, yourself, and everyone else. Thanks so much for being here so far tonight. We're going to break for 15 minutes. If you've not had a chance to register, and this is your first night, I want to encourage you to do that. All you're doing is letting us know how you found out about the series. We won't use your information except for to thank you for letting us know that. If you register, our gift to you at the end of the series is an entire recording of the whole set of the entire series with all the handouts that will be given to you as our thank you gift, just for letting us know how you found out about this series. Thank you so much for being here. Enjoy your refreshments. Make sure you get your handout for the next presentation. We'll see you in 15 minutes.